This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green. Now we turn to a film that's called The Stoning of Soraya M. Sadly, it's based on a real incident that took place in 1986 in a remote village in Iran. A woman named Soraya was framed for adultery by her husband, and then she was punished, stoned to death. Soraya's aunt, Zara, is the heroine. She exposes Soraya's story to the world when she meets a French journalist who just happened to be stranded in the village.
Today I am old. 100 years older than yesterday. But I know right from wrong. What happened here yesterday was wrong.
Zara's part is played by Academy Award nominee Shireh Aghdashloo. She and the film's director, Cyrus Noreste, came into our studios at NPR West to talk about making this film, which does not shy away from some brutal violence.
I wanted people to never forget what a stoning really is. I tried to search out stonings in other movies, and they're all kind of like one rock gets thrown and the person keels over. Also, this movie, this is the climax of the movie, but what's wonderful about it is after the stoning, Zahra, the heroine of the movie, played so beautifully by Shireh, turns this into a kind of triumph because she recognizes the importance of this story getting out and the world knowing what happened here so that this woman's death was not in vain.
And Shireh Aghdashloo is with you and played the part of Zara, who is Soraya's aunt. Was that a difficult scene to be involved in?
Indeed it was, David. It took 6 days to shoot, and of course Cyrus covered it from all angles. I believe it was on the fourth or fifth day. I was sitting on the ground waiting for the next shot to come, and I opened my eyes for 1 second, and all I could see were dust, angry feet pounding the ground, angry fists in the air, and all I could hear was shouting, you know, Allahu Akbar, God is great. For 1 second, I really had a hard time to tell the difference between reality and cinema.
I'd actually like to know more about Zara, the heroine of the film who you played. Clearly a strong person, very outspoken, especially in, you know, given the setting Iran at that time. And she seemed very respected by a lot of the village. And your character ends the movie with some of the only English that was used in the film. Let's take a listen.
They refused to let us bury her. We took her body and left it by the river. In the town, they were celebrating.
And that's your character, Zara, speaking about her niece, Soraya. And who is Zara? Do we know what happened to the real Zara after the story came out?
We vaguely know that after Soraya died, Zahra took care of the daughters of her daughters for a few years, and then she died of natural causes. That's all we know. She's a very powerful, strong woman, and the reason she's so powerful is because, according to herself, she was once somebody in this town. She was married to the mayor of the town, and most probably all these men who are running her around like a dog now were at her disposal once.
Let me ask you both, the book by the French journalist who happened to arrive in this village and hear from Zara about these events, the book came out in 1994, not that long ago. Are stonings still common in Iran even today?
Well, I wouldn't say common. They do happen. Our feeling is one is too many. Also, it is codified in the justice system. There have been moratoriums against it and attempts to stop it.
As recently as 2002, right?
Moratorium was... and that was called for by a cleric as well. And there are women's groups inside of Iran trying to stop this. So this is very much an issue inside of Iran.
I want to ask you about one scene where the mayor, the mullah, struck me as knowing that what happened in their village was wrong and they didn't want anyone in the world to know about it.
Yes.
Explain that to me. If they claim that these types of events, punishments are justified
right
in law, but yet they just seem to know that what they were doing was wrong and horrific.
Well, I think also because they knew she was innocent. And I think even those who support this being in the Islamic Penal Code are still a little bit embarrassed about the subject and don't like to talk about it. And that's a good thing. And that's another reason why we're happy to shed light on it.
We've been listening to Cyrus Naraste, the director of the film The Stoning of Soraya M., and also Sheree Agdashloo, who stars in the movie as the heroine Zara. Thank you both for being here and talking about this.
Thank you so much, David.
NPR's business news starts with another spike in unemployment. The government says the economy lost another 467,000 jobs in June. Unemployment is now 9.5%. This is the worst time in decades to be looking for a job. Imagine if you're a new college graduate thrust into the job market for the first time. NPR's Martin Costi takes a look at how graduates are faring.
Kimberly Betts, director of career development at Minnesota's St. Catherine University, says last fall's economic meltdown came as such a shock to many college seniors, their reaction was to postpone their job search.
They wanted to wait a little bit, see if the market picked up. They wanted to kind of maybe not deal with it right away.
Indeed, in a national survey of students completing bachelor's degrees this spring, less than 20% said they'd lined up full-time jobs. Compare that to 50% 2 years ago. The survey was conducted by the National Association of Colleges and Employers. Researcher Edwin Koch says despite the bleak numbers, the new grads seem oddly confident.
A majority of the students responding to the survey think that they will be employed within 3 months of their graduation. We don't think, to a certain extent, that the ramifications of the economic situation have completely sunk in.
Then again, maybe these college graduates are right not to panic.
There are 12.5 million job openings in the United States currently.
Melanie Holmes is a VP with the employment services company Manpower.
We know that the hardest jobs to fill in the United States include engineers, nurses, teachers, sales reps, technicians, and IT staff.
Many of those openings are off the beaten path, say in rural hospitals, but that's where recent graduates have a leg up on older job hunters. It's a lot easier for a 22-year-old, unburdened by mortgage or kids, to go to where the work is. Martin Costi, NPR News.
And to talk more about the U.S. offensive in Afghanistan, we're joined by the Obama administration's National Security Advisor, retired Marine General James Jones. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Melissa.
General Jones, how would you describe the mission that got underway yesterday?
This is an operations designed to bring confidence to the people of the region, bring a certain level of security, and hopefully that will be followed by economic development and better governance and rule of law and cooperation with the governor of the region.
All of those things you're talking about, General Jones, would require solid commitment on the Afghan side from both the military and the government. And there has been, as you know, a lot of skepticism about the Afghans' ability to hold up essentially their end of the deal. How much do you share in that concern?
Well, I do share in that concern. And I also know that the Afghan army and the security forces are not we don't have the numbers that we hope to have, say, a year from now. But it's also an international responsibility, I think. We have 47 countries with us in the region. We have the UN, we have NATO, the EU, and it seems to me that we should be able to put things together in such a way that when we establish security, we can very quickly roll in with some economic development and make sure that the people of the region, whether it's at the local, regional, or national government level, are led by competent people who are not corrupt and who have their interests at heart.
And when you say we don't have the numbers on the Afghan side, how far off are you from where you would want to be?
Well, the size of the Afghan army is about 80,000 now, and we're growing at the rate of about 2,000 a month. Our goal was about 136,000. They can't be everywhere at once, and so I think what we need to do is make sure that they are in those places where they need to be. We simply have to have the people of Afghanistan see their Afghan authorities taking control of their own destiny.
I'd like to ask you about that because our producer, Graham Smith, has reported that the people in this valley where he is right now trust the Afghan police less than they trust the Taliban. How do you overcome that deep suspicion now, born of many years' experience, of local Afghan government officials.
Exactly, and that's part of the problem, and that's why we believe there's a three legs to the stool. The security piece is what we traditionally do very well, but security without economic development, and more importantly without the local face of the Afghan police and Afghan military to convince the people that they're not only there, but they're going to stay there, is really what we need to concentrate on.
General Jones, I'd like to ask you about troop levels in Afghanistan. You told the Washington Post that your message to commanders there on your recent visit is that troop levels will hold steady and that they need to focus on economic development and governance. And I'm wondering how you square that with what seems to be a different message coming from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Michael Mullen. He told the Washington Post that the commanding general in Afghanistan is advised that he should tell the administration, here's what I need. There are no intended limits, no preconditions. In his words, ask for what you need. How do those two things get reconciled?
Correct. And I've had a conversation with my good friend Admiral Mullen this morning on that, and there really isn't any daylight. My message was one to convey that we have a process and we have a strategy. The strategy was formally adopted barely 90 days ago. We are in the middle of ramping up our forces to a total of 68,000, which is 21,000 more. This is what was asked for. And the president agreed to authorize this. And my message was simply to say that, you know, before we go back and ask for still additional forces, that we should make sure that we see how the strategy is being implemented. Absent any overwhelming reason that you would have to rush forces into Afghanistan, it seems to me that and to the, more importantly, to the president, that we should get a measure of how we're doing strategically to make sure that the entire gamut of the strategy is working. And it certainly wasn't intended on my part to say that at no time could we ever come back with good reason to make another case. In due time, when we see how the strategy is working, if we need to adjust it, they certainly can do what they feel they need to do.
General Jones, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're certainly welcome.
It's retired Marine Corps General James Jones. He's the White House National Security Advisor.
President Obama held a town hall meeting on health care yesterday in Annandale, Virginia. That's just outside the nation's capital. Mr. Obama pushed again for quick action on the sweeping health care overhaul now being considered by Congress. And among the changes he is seeking is a greater emphasis on preventing disease.
We need to invest in prevention and wellness that help Americans live longer, healthier lives. We know this saves money.
But just how much money prevention can actually save is one of the central questions in the healthcare debate. When you give people more access to healthcare, do costs go up because people start getting a lot of expensive care they might not really need? Or do costs go down because people get the care that really keeps them healthy? Researchers are looking into that very question and have come up with some suggestions for policymakers, as NPR's Joseph Shapiro explains.
The same questions came up in another expansion of healthcare just recently. In 2006, Medicare for the first time started paying for prescription drugs for seniors. The program is called Medicare Part D. Joseph Newhouse is a Harvard researcher.
There was a debate when Part D was being enacted. Proponents of the drug benefit wanted to argue that it would save money elsewhere, even though it would obviously cost money to buy the drugs. And the opponents argued that it would not save money elsewhere.
So Newhouse and his co-researchers went back and studied what happened when people got the new drug benefit. They looked at people who had no drug coverage before, and they looked at people who had just some, but not very much, drug coverage. Both groups started spending more on medications, but both groups also spent less on going to doctors and hospitals. Newhouse says these people got access to preventive care that kept them healthy, and it ended up saving Medicare money.
People have better insurance. They use more. And that's true in drugs, and in the case of drugs for chronic conditions that people should be taking their medications to control their conditions, such as high blood pressure or diabetes, that can prevent future costs.
But there was another group Newhouse looked at, people who already had very good drug coverage and then got more under Medicare. They also spent more on drugs, but unlike the other groups, their visits to doctors and hospitals went up. Newhouse says this suggests that sometimes people can get too much care, especially the elderly who use more medications than any other age group.
There's some overprescribing of drugs in the elderly. The elderly frequently have pillbox after pillbox in their medicine cabinet. Some of these drugs may have side effects that can actually raise costs, in the worst case by precipitating some kind of hospitalization, but in any event precipitating doctor's visits and monitoring to see what's going on.
The cost of the new Medicare drug benefit ended up being less than Congress projected. Tricia Newman of the Kaiser Family Foundation says it was for reasons that were a surprise.
There were things that happened that weren't predicted, and one is an overall reduction in the growth in drug spending in the nation as a whole, and people changed their practices. A lot of people switched from brand names to generics, which had an effect on overall spending.
So healthcare is complex, and practices by patients and doctors evolve, and that makes it hard to accurately forecast the cost of change. The new research appears in the New England Journal of Medicine. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
Now, the Madoff story about money, massive fraud, a once prominent figure, is just the kind of tale that gets the hearts of investigative reporters thumping. But these have been tough times in the world of journalism, and with newspapers struggling to survive and cutting their budgets, some reporters are moving on to other trades. NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik has been speaking to some of these former journalists about what they're doing now. And David joins us from our New York studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
The people we're talking about today, I mean, I think of them as those classic reporters, you know, the whiskey drinking, chain smoking, meet their source in an alley kind of reporters.
Guys look like an unmade bed.
Right.
Well, in reality, the way they think of their job is finding things out and getting people to say things that those people don't want to make public. And it can be through conversation and it can be through rigorous sifting through data. You know, a number of investigative reporters are bailing out for corporate gigs in political PR, some becoming actual private investigators. But I spoke to two veteran investigative reporters, both guys who spent long stints at the Los Angeles Times, both leaving the field of journalism voluntarily to seek a new form of public service. And I wanted to start with Joel Sapel. One of his greatest reporting projects at the Los Angeles Times took 5 years. He revealed secrets of the sprawling Scientology empire of the late L. Ron Hubbard. And here's what he described it felt like while he was doing that reporting.
We had private detectives. We were sued 4 times. I was falsely accused of criminal assault. There was a lot of stuff that went on during that period.
That was Joel Sapel talking about what it was like to investigate the empire of the Scientologists. Sapel held other editing and reporting jobs over the years, but about a year ago, after struggling with the decision, he left for a job with a powerful local politician, Los Angeles County Supervisor Zev Yaroslavsky. And here's what Sapel told me about how he feels about his new position.
I'm working for the people. And I love that feeling. I like that feeling better than working at the LA Times. I like knowing that I'm doing something that's a pure, unadulterated public service.
That's the voice of former investigative reporter Joel Sapel, who spoke to NPR's David Folkenflik. And he's happy with the move away from journalism, it sounds like.
He loves it. He's using his reportorial skills to figure out what's going wrong in county government and how things might be improved. His inquiries on behalf of Yaroslavsky helped lead the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office to count all of its unprocessed rape kits. It turned out there were thousands, and then helped to encourage the department to start to process them to identify possible suspects.
Well, David, someone like Sapel leaves the newspaper world. What do they think of the work newspapers are doing?
People like Joel and others who I talked to said that they have a lot of respect for reporters and editors who are still striving under terrible economic pressures to do good work. And there's a lot of good work being done. The LA Times itself, they've done major enterprise stories on brush fires in Los Angeles and on the gang system there, for example. When I talked to LA Times editor Russ Stanton, he says, look, our commitment is unwavering to investigative and enterprise journalism. It's a point of distinction for us. Then again, I talked to a guy who had risen to the level of managing editor at the LA Times named Doug France. He had also been at the New York Times, St. Petersburg Times previously. Last year, France said he looked around and he told me he didn't see a lot of appealing opportunities left in journalism.
The issue for me has always been can I find a job where I can look myself in the mirror every morning before I go to work and say, I'm going to do good?
Former Los Angeles Times journalist Doug France, he says he's now found that chance to do good. He's the chief investigator for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, headed by Senator John Kerry. Now France is sort of gunning not for the front page, but for a direct impact on national policy. Here's what he said when I talked to him.
My first and highest responsibility there was to produce something that would inform Senator John Kerry, my boss. In a sense, everything that I do and write is for an audience of one.
We've been talking to NPR's David Folkenflik about several former investigative reporters. And David, if folks like this have moved on out of journalism entirely, who's filling that watchdog role that they used to fill?
Well, I think one of the most fascinating things are the development of not-for-profits. There are these established larger national ones in California, the Center for Investigative Reporting, in D.C., the Center for Public Integrity, ProPublica, now a new one in New York. But there are also smaller regional and local ones, often based within universities, that are providing, through the work of young rising journalists and through the oversight of former newspaper investigative reporters, reports that appear on front pages of major newspapers. Walter Robinson, a former lead investigative reporter at the Boston Globe, is overseeing projects that now appear on the Globe's front pages. Several ProPublica reporters used to be with the LA Times, and their exposés have appeared on the front pages of the LA Times.
I guess the reality that newspapers and other old-time media has to face today.
I don't think anyone's doing it alone anymore.
David, thanks a lot for bringing these voices to us.
You bet.
NPR's David Folkenflik joined us from our New York bureau. And we should note that just yesterday, a coalition of nonprofit news organizations, including NPR, announced plans to work together on investigative reporting projects.